Rome is the eternal city, Paris is the city of light, and London has fog.
A foggy day in London town had me low and had me down.
And it's not just historical. In just the first week of 2016, London's air exceeded its annual limit for the toxic gas nitrogen dioxide. But it used to be far, far worse. For days at a time, foul, stagnant, smoky air would settle over the city, turning day into night and sickening thousands. And yet, some Londoners had a strange affection for this environmental hazard. And the London fog's murky shadow was reflected by writers and painters and filmmakers. Well, now there's a new book that examines these legendary pea soupers from writer Christine Corton called London Fog, The Biography. And we sent our resident British expat Helen Palmer to talk to her.
Christine Corton, you're the author of London Fog, The Biography. I'm interested into why you decided it should be a biography rather than, say, the history.
Because I wanted to see it in terms of it being born and in terms of it being killed off, dying. I wanted to see it having a kind of personality of its own. It was loved by Londoners as well as loathed. And that was why it was called all these names. So it was named London Particular in a very affectionate way, because Londoners wanted to show how proud they were of it. After all, there is an upside to London fog, smoke. If you've got smoke in the air, it means you've got employment in industry, and it means you can afford to have an open fire to warm yourself. But Londoners were essentially quite proud of it. They felt it created a distinction for them as a city.
Let's have you read a piece from the book. There's a passage I particularly like on page 245. It's a quotation from The Times from December 1924.
Yes, OK. The London Particular is the true London pride. It is unique, no less than is London gin or London wit. Other places may be able to show a mist or so. Only London has fog. And Londoners are secretly proud of it. Only the largest shareholders in gas and electric light companies, the launderers, and perhaps the soap and face cream trades, dare to confess their joy in a thorough London fog. But every Londoner feels, on such a day as yesterday, the distinction of being a citizen of so singular a town. Fog breaks the monotony of life. It shows us our familiar surroundings in a new and an artificial light. It gives us something to talk about. And those of us who live to see the sensible thing done at last, and the London Particular deprived of its artificial foulness, will find ourselves sighing for the good old days.
That's a lovely piece of writing. But in fact, the fog that they're describing was particularly awful. It was full of soot. It was full of what?
Well, it was full of particles, basically, from uncombusted coal. So it was very visible. It would turn the colour of the fog green, yellow, mainly yellow, black sometimes. But it was very dangerous to breathe in. And people would quite often cough up black spit, which showed what they were actually kind of taking in, digesting. And you could suffocate. If your lungs were weak, if you were elderly or very young, you could literally suffocate because you couldn't actually get rid of these rather nasty particles from your lungs.
And in fact, the fogs did bring much higher mortality when they were really bad.
Yes, the 1952 smog, which is probably the one most people are aware of, killed possibly about 12,000 people. It's very difficult to kind of give statistics because, of course, government said, well, they would have died anyway because they already had lung issues, they had heart issues, or they died from the flu. So quite often governments would blame it on colds or flu. But nowadays we reckon the 52 smog probably killed about 12,000 people.
London's a big city, but still that's a lot of people.
It is, especially when you consider that that's a week's worth of fog. Of course, they didn't die during that week. They may have died 2 or 3 months later, but there's no doubt about it. The hospitals suddenly had these queues of people who had breathing problems, who had to be put on oxygen, who literally couldn't actually survive breathing the air in.
So You talked about uncombusted carbon. This was basically because there was a lot of industry in London, and of course, everybody had a coal fire. That was how we heated and that was how we cooked our food.
Yes, and people did like their coal fire. And one of the problems with trying to introduce legislation to combat this problem, and believe me, they did try many, many times from the early 19th century onwards, people kept saying, well, we have no real alternative to our coal fire. And even when they did, they were in love with their coal fire. They liked it being the central, the focal part of their living room.
You write about how it inspired so many writers and indeed artists, particularly artists, and how it appears in both our literature and our painting in this very romantic light as this very sort of mysterious covering, as this indeed this personage in our literature.
Yes, it's interesting that almost all writers one time or another uses London fog as a metaphor. Dickens obviously is the one we would first of all go to, and he uses London fog in a variety of ways. In Bleak House, he uses it as a metaphor for the law. Our Mutual Friend, it becomes a metaphor for the corruption of the city. Other writers such as Joseph Conrad use it. The artists, that's an interesting story on its own, because English artists such as George Vigat Cole, W.L. Wiley, they all tried to paint the London atmosphere as it appeared to them. So with a kind of dirty black haze, showing steam-powered engines in the distance, creating this smog. But in fact, none of these paintings were really acceptable, because most of the industrialists who were buying paintings at that time, they didn't want to see the products of their own industries being kind of portrayed in paint. So poor old Wiley, in fact, he painted a wonderful picture in the 1870s, and somebody actually put a knife through it. He disliked it so much. So it's not really until Impressionism really takes hold, Monet comes over and paints London fog, and he paints it in this very impressionistic way. You can see the different colours that the fog produces to his eye. He's got purples, he's got green, he's got yellows. And you can see that there's an energy behind it, which comes across. But interestingly, he never actually exhibited these paintings in London. Most of them were sold by foreign buyers. So even in the early 20th century, this kind of art wasn't really acceptable.
You also talk about how deadly the fog was for animals at the Great Smithfield Show, this very famous show in London, Smithfield's the meat market, and where they bought all their prize animals, their prize bulls, and the best of the British agricultural product there. And these fogs were absolutely deadly for the cattle.
Yes, the main one is the 1873 show, which there was a week-long fog outbreak just as the show was opened. And these very well-bred, very expensive cattle really suffered. They're seen as panting piteously. Many of them just die on the spot. They just collapse. In order to try and relieve their pain, they're actually taken outside. But of course, outside is foggy as well. I mean, it's not as it, and the fog was creeping into the Islington insides as well. So about 80 prize cattle died.
It's strange. I mean, we're such animal lovers, you would have thought that that would have galvanised them into action, at least.
Well, there were various newspaper reports of how animals in London Zoo suffered because of the London fog. So any animal with white fur, such as polar bears, their fur would be covered in these black particles. A, that wasn't very good for them, but B, of course, they would actually try and clean their fur, and by doing that, they would then be taking in even more particles. And in fact, zookeepers said that during foggy days, the animals showed a loss of vitality, they seemed generally depressed, and of course, it was argued, well, if this is what's happening to animals in the zoo, can you imagine what it's doing to people?
Christine, you write about how basically people were constantly getting lost. They couldn't find their way around. I mean, cabbies were getting lost, and even policemen couldn't always find their way around. How did people navigate from A to B if they had to go out in London?
Well, in the 19th century, they used young men sometimes older men, who would carry links. They were known as link lighters, and they would carry these flaming torches and promise to lead people back to their homes or to the theatre or wherever. In fact, of course, many of these link lighters were connected to criminal gangs and would often lead the poor unfortunate people up an alley where they'd be sandbagged, i.e. hit on the back of a head with a bag of sand, and they would be robbed. But link lighters actually appear in a lot of paintings of foggy days, and you can see them almost causing more trouble than they're worth, because they're waving their lit torches around. Somehow they're kind of burning people's, singeing people's hair. They often kind of drop their torches onto people's feet. So they're seen as kind of mischief makers, as well as, I say, being tied to crime.
It's extraordinary. Given all these sort of like bad things about the fog, why did it really take so long to get it cleaned up?
Well, campaigners tried from very early on to clean it up. From the early 19th century, there are people such as a politician called Taylor, Mackinnon in the 1840s, Palmerston had a go in the 1850s. They all tried to bring in smoke abatement acts, but technology isn't there to support these acts, but also it's vested interests. If you're an industrialist and you're trying to make a profit, if you try to improve your chimneys, if you try to clean up the amount of smoke that's going out from the chimney, it's going to cost you money. It means you have to put in new equipment. It means you have to train your stokers to combust the fire quicker. So this is going to cost you money. So of course you're going to be reluctant to see an act passed, especially when you yourself as a wealthy industrialist can actually go and live out in the country. You don't have to breathe London's air.
And then, of course, we had interruptions like wars and slumps and the like. And so there were always reasons why this got interrupted.
We had the First World War. But after that, of course, then the country was trying to get back on its feet. And of course, the last thing it wanted to think about was to actually spend more money on converting people's grates. Then, of course, we have the Second World War. Again, in the late 1940s, there's a real effort to produce a really strong Clean Air Act. But the coal industry has been nationalised, and there's a deep suspicion that for the domestic market, the coal board is actually supplying a lot of very cheap, dirty coal, which is producing more smoke. And we're actually sending our more expensive coal abroad because we need the money. So again, governments are very reluctant to interfere with that. It was really the 1952 smog that made all the difference.
Well, I'm particularly interested in this because I grew up in Worcestershire, and my local MP, Gerald Nabarro, MP for Kidderminster, I grew up 3 miles from Kidderminster, was the man who in the end actually got the Clean Air Act on the books.
Yes, it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, for your listeners who don't know anything about Gerald Nabarro, he was actually quite a character. He was against the joining the European Union. He was a racist. He was actually caught going around the roundabout the wrong way by a policeman who took a photograph. And he said, well, it wasn't me who went round the roundabout. It was my secretary. And the policeman said, well, she must have a very fine moustache, just like yours, because he had this very distinguished handlebar moustache. So he's not, you know, immediately someone that you would actually say was a hero. But in terms of clean air, he was a hero. He decided that he would push the Clean Air Act through. So he took advice from the smoke abatement societies that were around at the time. He actually introduced a 10-point plan. He had a franking machine for his post, which actually said support the Clean Air Act. So he really put a lot of effort behind it. The only thing was the government fell. But both Labour and Conservative parties had clean air measures in their manifestos, because I think they saw the tide had turned. People were no longer going to accept London that actually was covered in smoke, that for as many as 3 weeks out of every year, over a period of the winter, you would have to walk in pitch black darkness during the day. I think also post-Second World War, people wanted a cleaner, better way of living. They felt they'd fought a war and they wanted actually to see positive measures coming from it, and they weren't prepared to accept what they saw as a very kind of primitive way of living through winter.
The fact that it took the fog so long to get cleaned up, and the fact that the fog was ultimately mostly cleaned up due to the insistence of a few people and the changes in technology. Do you think this has a lesson for us in terms of addressing global warming now?
Yes, I think one of the lessons is to be patient, but also I think you've got to be persistent, not accept government inaction. I think governments can sit on their hands and just hope it'll go away. And I think that's the story of London fog. Governments were very reluctant to pass acts, even the 1956 Clean Air Act. That really happened because of Nabarro's insistence and forcefulness, and the fact that all the newspapers started saying, this is a killer, this is poison, we have to do something about it. Macmillan, who was Minister of Housing for the time, was very reluctant to pass the Clean Air Act. And just as we see our ministers today, and I can only talk obviously of the London, England, Great Britain situation, they're very reluctant to interfere with the rights of the driver, because we all like to use our cars, and yet we don't want to breathe in the pollution that the exhaust fumes produce. So it's a very similar story to coal fires.
That's Christine Corton, the author of London Fog, the biography. She spoke with Living on Earth's Helen Palmer.